real risks now stemming from the continued war with Iran and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz are downstream risks from the core output commodities that you're all familiar with. So let's talk about that. Of course, liquid natural gas is one of the core commodities. The Ras Laffan gas field out of Qatar is still not functioning since March, by the way. And two of those trains have a 3 to 5 year repair time. So there's also a very long tail risk of an extended restart time window for a lot of these things to come back online. But what's downstream from natural gas? This is critical to understand. So aluminum smelting is one of the downstream results of natural gas. And that's because aluminum smelting is extremely energy intensive. And this is why some of the largest aluminum smelters in the world are located in the Middle East, where they have access to the natural gas energy. So remember that, you know, mining aluminum, you don't get it out of the ground in a pure form, obviously. You get it out in rock, basically, or just, you know, looks like rock, looks like large chunks of gravel or whatever, and then you have to smelt the aluminum out of that. That is extremely energy intensive. And when you don't have the energy, you can't do the smelting. This is why aluminum prices are already skyrocketing around the world. So if you don't have affordable high volumes of aluminum, then, you know, how do you make aircraft? How do you make weapon systems? How do you make cars? You know, how do you make Teslas? Because the Gigafactory is using like a unified aluminum frame that's stamped out all at once. Well, it's not just stamped out. I mean, it's they melt the aluminum and push it into a mold, basically. But you have to have high volumes of relatively cheap aluminum in order to make these other products. No aluminum, no cars, no aircraft, and lots of other things that depend on aluminum, such as conductive cabling for data centers, for example. You know, it's not just copper, it's also a lot of aluminum. So keep your eyes on the aluminum commodity, because those prices will continue to rise as scarcity worsens. Now, other downstream things. Phosphate fertilizers, for example. We talk about nitrogen fertilizers, but and nitrogen, of course, created through the Haber-Bosch process, which also uses natural gas as the energy source in order to extract and effectively crack nitrogen out of the atmosphere. Because, you know, almost 80% of the atmospheric air is nitrogen, but it's bound up as N2, nitrogen with nitrogen. And it takes a tremendous amount of heat and pressure in order to break that molecular bond. So that's where natural gas comes into play. That's why, again, the nitrogen processing plants that create things like urea are also, many of them are located in the Middle East. But phosphate fertilizers use a different downstream process, and that is sulfuric acid. So when you refine oil that is considered sour oil, sour means high sulfur content. That's really all it means. So a sour oil has to have sulfur removed. Removing the sulfur results in the creation of a massive sulfur stockpile. And remember, there are, of course, oil refineries all throughout the Middle East and elsewhere around the world, but a lot of them are located in the Middle East, obviously, and, you know, Russia too. I'm not dismissing that. I'm just saying there's a heavy concentration of oil processing in the Middle East because that's where a lot of the oil comes from. So they end up with these large stockpiles of sulfur. And then when you modify the sulfur, you get sulfuric acid. The sulfuric acid is what's necessary to process raw mined phosphate rock into phosphorus that's suitable for fertilizers. So without the sulfuric acid, you can't get the phosphorus out of the rock because you have to dissolve the rock. And sulfuric acid is very good at doing that. So you think about nitrogen and phosphorus as two of the most important materials in agriculture, we're talking about global food production here, both of those are under a chokehold right now because of Trump's war against Iran, which he continues to escalate as well. So these downstream effects are going to result in, of course, global, well, famine around the world, but not everywhere in the world. So I don't think we'll see mass famine in the United States, but we will see widespread famine in Southeast Asia, in countries like Somalia, in Yemen. We're going to see food scarcity get a lot worse in India even, but especially places like Bangladesh and the sub-Saharan Africa, lots of nations there as well. Maybe even Egypt could be impacted by this to some extent. So those are some of the downstream effects just stemming from, you know, fertilizer materials. Now, what will hit the United States is the downstream supply chain shortage of diesel and jet fuel, because refining those products requires you to use a heavier crude oil, such as the kind of oil that comes from out of the Urals in Russia, or the kind of oil that comes out of Saudi Arabia or also Iran, but not so much the sweet light crude that we get out of the United States for the most part. So the oil that we get in the U.S. is the lighter oil, which is great for refining into lighter products such as gasoline and also naphtha, which we'll talk about naphtha here in a second. But diesel and jet fuel are much more efficiently processed out of the heavier oils, and also the refineries that we have in the United States are set up to process those heavier oils. And that's the kind of oil that comes out of Venezuela as well, at least that's my understanding. So you can't just take a refinery that's configured for producing gasoline and that's used to handling light, sweet, crude inputs. You can't just take that and then say the next day, oh, we're going to make diesel out of this and we're going to process heavy oil, you know, high sulfur content oil. It doesn't work that way. You could switch over refineries over a period of maybe a year or two, but not overnight. Now, there are also downstream effects from the helium shortage. You may know that helium is used in medical imaging, MRIs in particular. But did you also know that helium is used in microchip manufacturing and high bandwidth memory and the kinds of hardware that are necessary to support the AI bubble, the whole AI infrastructure build out? Those data centers, they depend on supplies that are manufactured, you know, microchips and memory manufactured using helium. Well, a significant portion of the helium, something like, I think, 25%, comes out of the Persian Gulf. And the second largest source of helium is China. And China just announced a ban on helium exports because of the global helium shortage that's taking place. Now, my laboratory, which is a food science lab, running multiple mass spec instruments, we also use helium in those instruments. And as you know, I purchased a year's supply of helium in March because I knew that this was coming, but very few labs purchased helium ahead of time. So now they're running into severe helium restrictions. So this is hitting hospitals and MRI centers, medical imaging, as well as laboratories and microchip manufacturing. Could that throw a wrench into the AI bubble? Yeah. And then there's naphtha. So naphtha is this lighter distilled hydrocarbon that is used. You can crack naphtha to make polypropylene, different kinds of plastics that are used in the food packaging industry, for example, all across, you know, grocery stores and foods and supplements and so on. Naphtha is also used, it's mixed with gasoline, or it's mixed with the feedstock products to make gasoline. Naphtha is used to make various solvents and certain types of lighter lubricants, for example. So without naphtha, then you have a problem with your food packaging industry. You have a problem making gasoline. You have a problem with some medical device manufacturing as well. So naphtha is one of these near universal molecules that's necessary to power modern civilization. And it's just one of many. And by the way, there's also a polyethylene shortage that's happening now. So if you don't have enough polyethylene, then, you know, think about all the things that are made from PE, from storage and transportation drums that hold liquids, to food packaging, to those little rings that are the fittings for plumbing on PEX pipes and everything. You know, without polyethylene, you can't build homes. You can't really run a food manufacturing facility. You know, you can't make a lot of medical devices. You can't make a lot of military devices and so on. Polyethylene has become one of the core materials of our modern society. You know, it's rugged. It's also slightly flexible and pliable. It resists cracking. It resists UV. You know, sunlight exposure doesn't destroy it, etc. It's incredibly useful. And a lot of that comes out of the Persian Gulf. But, you know, not anymore. So really, when you put all of this together and you start looking at the downstream effects of all of these key materials and molecules, you come to realize that this isn't just a supply shock of one or two things. This is a supply shock of many of the base materials on which modern human civilization functions. Without these materials, you can't run a modern society. And so, if this war continues, the civilization cannot function. Not at the current scale. Something has to give. Something has to be radically downsized in order for our world to function on, you know, a fraction of the supply that we are used to. So let me ask you this question. What has to give in order to function on a fraction of the fertilizer that we were used to? Well, clearly, population. Because how are you going to feed 8 billion people if you lose, you know, 30% of your fertilizer, or more like 33%, a third? How are you going to feed the world? Well, you can't, actually. How are you going to fuel the world? You know, how are you going to fuel the transportation? The trucks that deliver the goods to the grocery store? Or the jets that provide air transport? How are you going to fuel them if you don't have the fuel? Well, you can't. So you have to start cutting transportation. Ultimately, the entire world here, if we don't get this back to normal, which seems almost impossible at this point, the world is going to have to downsize. It's going to have to downsize its economy, its industry, its population, its farming, food production, you know, manufacturing of technology, you know, medical operations, just you name it. All of that is going to have to be downsized. And what goes along with that is, of course, in many countries, an unreliable power grid, a massive global loss of jobs. You simply won't have the jobs because the industry isn't functioning, you see. The industry doesn't have energy. The industry doesn't have raw materials. You're going to have a global contraction that will be far worse than the Great Depression. It's a global collapse. And along with that global collapse, you will have, as you might expect, a social uprising. You'll have revolts. You'll have political strife. You'll have revolutions and wars. Wars over resources, wars over food, wars over water. And by the way, without cheap, abundant energy, how are you going to move water? How are you going to desalinate water? How are you going to run the farms? And the answer is, you know, you can't. And I'm not saying that everything collapses. No, I've given you numbers here. In some cases, it's a 20% reduction in, let's say, global oil. It's a 25% reduction in LNG. It's a 33% reduction in fertilizer. For some of these, it can be up to a 50% reduction in polyethylene, for example. But these are the ranges that we're dealing with. So somewhere between, let's say, 20% and 50% of the world that we know today will have to cease to exist to match the output restrictions from the Strait of Hormuz. So, yes, what I'm saying is effectively what Trump is putting into play here is a global population reduction plan that inevitably will see anywhere from 20 to 50% of the world's current population gone. You know, death through not just famine and starvation, but, you know, war and strife and lack of access to energy, lack of employment, followed by all kinds of social ramifications, etc. So that's the upshot of this. It's not just that we're lacking some oil and that gas prices are going to go up. No, we're talking about a global catastrophe that can only be brought back into homeostasis through a global population reduction of at minimum 20%. So, and probably closer to 25%. So we're talking about close to 2 billion people dying as a result of Trump's war, which would make this, over 300 times worse than the Holocaust of World War II, something like that. So Trump would be, I guess, historically 300 times worse than Hitler in terms of the number of people that he kills. How about that? 300 Hitlers. Yeah, pretty bad. So how can we stop that scenario? Well, we have to get back to peace. We have to get back to trade. We have to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which is never going to happen under U.S. control. That's clear. The way that Trump could actually save the world from his own wars is to leave the Middle East, walk away, and then things could get back to normal and we wouldn't have that scenario that I just described. We could recover. There'll still be some level of famine in 2027, but it wouldn't be, you know, a wipeout level. So if you want to help save the world, just call for peace and call for the removal of Trump, who's clearly a delusional madman, full of himself, who thinks that he's ordained by God to save the world while he's actually destroying it. He needs to be removed from power. 25th Amendment or whatever is appropriate. But join me in calling for peace, and you can follow my work at brightvideos.com. You can get prepared for more chaos and collapse with a number of methods. Check out our sponsor, the Satellite Phone Store, sat123.com. Not only do they have satellite phones, but they have, you know, power stations, solar generators, Faraday bags, and things like that. But also visit our online store, healthrangerstore.com, for backup, long-term storable food supplies, as well as personal care products and nutritional supplements, things that can help you stay alive during this time of extreme turmoil that will last for years to come. This won't be over overnight. This is already going to bleed well into 2027, 2028. I mean, gosh, you know, the LNG repair time just at the Qatar Ras Laffan is 3 to 5 years. Okay. So, you know, that's going to push us into 2030 before we can even think about getting back to normal. So this is going to be a multi-year supply chain catastrophe, and that's already determined. That's not a what if. That's done. So prepare for a multi-year era of chaos. And thank you for listening. Yeah, happy day. You know, hey, I'm not trying to get you down. I'm not trying to be a doomer. I'm just trying to be realistic about all of this. Like, where is this actually going? That's all. I want you to be prepared. I want you to make it through this. I want you to achieve abundance and safety and security. I want you to live through this and do well. And that means facing the reality of where we are. And we're in a tough spot right now. So thank you for listening. Mike Adams here, the Health Ranger, naturalnews.com, and also brightvideos.com. Take care. I recently interviewed Tucker Carlson on my show, Decentralized TV, with Todd Pittner, my co-host. We had a great time. And during the interview, Tucker was talking about real abundance or real wealth versus artificial wealth. And we agreed in the conversation that we are wealthy because we have the natural world around us. We are wealthy because we have our health, our minds, we have ethics and values. That's real wealth. And yet we live in a world Well, and Tucker was talking about how he has interacted with so many wealthy billionaires, that is, you know, financially wealthy, and he says they're miserable. And they want what we have, which is a natural joy, you know, a natural happiness. And what they have instead is this, you know, panic about holding on to their wealth and, you know, relationship problems, which seem to be made worse by having more money, not less, and so on. So I want to talk today here about natural wealth and how the measures of wealth that are taught to us by our twisted society are deceptive and false. And they get us to focus on the wrong things, which is like, how many numbers do you have in your bank account when you log in? Now, I am not in any way denying the obvious truth that a certain amount of money is useful in our practical world. You do need some amount of money to, you know, pay the rent, buy the house, own some land. So to some extent, a certain amount of money can help you create conditions that are conducive to your freedom, such as living more off-grid. I totally understand that. I get it. You know, a solar system is expensive. Buying 100 acres of land in your favorite county is also expensive, etc. I understand that. Paying off your house costs money. But seeking to acquire enough money to buy a piece of land and pay off your home and own a decent car and live off-grid, that's not a sickness. That's a practical, you know, survival strategy. That's healthy. The sickness comes from people who think that they have to have, you know, billions more of everything, and they have to have, you know, a third home and a fourth home, and they have to have a home that's got 12 bedrooms or, you know, whatever, this kind of thing. And this is a sickness of the love of money, which is what is said to be the root of all evil. Not money itself, but the love of money. Now, there's also another saying that says the best things in life are free. There's some truth to that, a lot of truth, that the things that really matter for your wealth, at least what I would call wealth, are things that cannot be bought, right? So, for example, if you're listening to this, you probably take care of your health better than most people. Your good health cannot be purchased. Can't trade dollars for health. Health is something that has to be earned, especially in your older years. You make the decision to eat healthier. You make the decision to take care of your physical health. You make the decision to have cleaner foods and, you know, not to pollute your body with toxic personal care products and garbage like that. You make the decision. You earn your health. And even a billionaire or someone who has all the money in the world can't buy that if they have neglected that for all the years that they've been around. They will age more quickly, and so far we don't have a method to buy back your years, do we? So that's just one thing, but there's much more to it. I was telling Tucker that I live on a ranch and I have a private exercise area, and I like to jog around the forest and I lift kettlebells in the forest. And I did a song about that called Iron and Sky, because I don't like to go into gymnasiums and, you know, fitness centers. Not that I have anything against them. It's just, that's not me. I don't like to work out indoors. I would much rather work out outdoors, even in the blazing heat or the cold or the rain or the wind or whatever. I still prefer the outdoors. So I was telling Tucker about this, and that along the way of my walking path, I also have loblolly pine trees, and then I get to pick the pine needles, and sometimes I just put them straight into my mouth, and I'll you know, like, suck on the pine needles, which is kind of weird because they're not very chewable. it's like chewing on little thin twigs, basically. But that's a great way to extract all of the natural medicine that's in the pine needles: shikimic acid, vitamin C, and so much more. So I was telling Tucker about this, and he's like, oh, that's amazing. I love that idea. That seems like a really great source of, you know, natural abundance, or however he said it. I'm paraphrasing. And then he told the story about how he has, I think it was like an outdoor hot tub, and he takes his dogs and he goes down some stairs outside to get to his hot tub. And he loves being out in nature, and he lives in a humble home. It's not very large. It's not some mansion or anything. And I really resonated with that too, because I've made a lot of the same choices. And these are not the choices of people who worship money. These are the choices of people who intentionally enjoy quality of life, which is, I would say, the real wealth. So let me ask you to start putting some value on some things that you have. Let's start with a funny one, the ability to poop. How about that? How much is the ability to poop worth? Well, if you can't poop, you will discover that the ability to poop is extremely valuable. It's funny to say, but that's a source of natural wealth, is your health, your ability to eliminate. If you can't poop or pee, if you can't sleep, if you can't have sex, if you can't walk, you know, any of these things take away from your actual wealth. And so having those things is natural wealth. It's a source of great abundance. Just the fact that you were gifted the body that you now inhabit is an incredible gift from our Creator, and possibly your parents were involved in that to some extent, your mother in particular. But it's an incredible gift that has unlimited wealth built into it, because through your physical body, you can do so many things. You can live out an entire human life, and you can take amazing actions, and you can accomplish so many things. That alone is a gift of incredible value. And again, even many billionaires are losing their physical bodies, and I guess we all get old eventually, but we age in different ways according to how well we take care of our health. So recognizing the value of that health and the value of being able to walk is extremely important if you want to have a joyous life of natural abundance. So if you could put a price on the ability to walk, what would be that price? You know, think about a person who is disabled, who cannot walk, living life in a wheelchair. What would be the value to that person, perhaps, of being able to walk if they could? Obviously, that would be a very high value. And yet, you and I, most of you listening to this, are ambulatory. And so we walk without thinking about it. We don't think about the value in it, do we? We just walk mindlessly, usually. Or the ability to use our hands. You know, I almost lost my index finger a few years ago, and I very quickly learned the value of having an index finger. Without that finger, a lot of things become much more difficult. And it really taught me more empathy for those who have lost limbs, veterans or in industrial accidents or what have you. I have a better understanding. I'm not saying that my injury is equivalent to their condition, because I still have all my fingers and both my hands, etc. But for a while, I had a little glimpse of what it might be like to lose a finger or lose a hand. And it gave me more appreciation for those who have suffered such losses. So what's the value of having, you know, 8 fingers and 2 thumbs? Huh? Pretty high value. What's the value of having an immune system? Well, there are people who have essentially no functioning immune systems that have to live, I guess the meme is they have to live in a bubble, they have to live in a protected environment because they can't, you know, their immune function doesn't work at all. They can't be exposed to even, you know, fungi or bacteria or what have you. But you and I, we get to move through the world mostly impervious to whatever germs are out there floating around. Why? Because we have a functioning immune system. It's something that has very high value, but it's something we often take for granted, of course. And when people forget the value of their immune system, then they forget to take zinc or to, you know, support their immune system with good nutrition. And that's also another kind of mistake, obviously. And I made that mistake recently, too. I was hit by something and I neglected to do the pine needle tea and other nutrients soon enough. I waited too long because I got busy and I wasn't taking the supplements that I knew I should have taken. And yeah, sure enough, it treated me badly. So I can make these same mistakes too, but it's a good reminder of the value of a functioning immune system. Now, there are other things that have tremendous value. I'll mention one that's important to me. You know, I'm very sensitive to synthetic fragrances. And so to me, it has a very high value to live far away from other people's homes because those other people do laundry and then their dryers spit out toxic fabric softener, detergent, and you know, all kinds of other odors that stinks up the whole freaking neighborhood. I can't stand to live in a neighborhood for that very reason. I can't live close to other people's homes because those other people are toxic. I mean, they live toxic lifestyles. They wash their clothes in toxic chemicals and then they put them on. They wear them. It's incredible. So yeah, I can't live next to those people. So for me, the ability to live away from those people has very high value. That's something that almost no billionaires have or very few. And some billionaires live in the middle of New York City, you know, high-rise luxury apartment or something. They don't even have a walking path. They don't have a walking path. I have more than they do just right outside my door. They can't grow pine trees in their apartments. You know what I mean? They don't have the natural outdoor environment that I have every day. I have access to for free every single day. I am wealthier than those billionaires. And it's not about what's in the bank. It's what's in your experiences, what's in your environments, what's around you that really counts. I get to drink clean rainwater. They have to drink bottled microplastic soup from their bottled water or something, you know? I get to hear locusts and tree frogs. I love the tree frogs. Helps me know what's happening in the environment. I listen to the frogs. I listen to the birds. Billionaires living in cities, they have to synthesize that with like sound machines, with bird sounds and things like that. I was like, really? Oh my God, I'm wealthier than they are just because I have live animals. I have a natural real world around me. So think about this. I consider my life to be wealthier than the lives of almost all billionaires. And yet achieving the life that I'm describing here doesn't cost $1 billion or not even anywhere near it. So I ask you this question. If you want to be richer than a billionaire, let's say, or wealthier than a billionaire, how little could it cost you to achieve that? And the answer is very little, not even $1 million, probably, depending on where you live. You could achieve the things that count in life with health and with joy and with creative expression or innovation or just having space, you know, having privacy, having silence. There's value in silence, you know, which may sound funny coming from a podcaster like myself, but I need silent time as well. And I don't want neighbors blasting, you know, party music all night or whatever, or fireworks, you name it. So how little in terms of money would it take for you to live better than a billionaire? And the answer is not that much. You could probably do it now. You might have to move, you know, if you live in a neighborhood with an HOA and a large house with very high property tax rates. You know, you might be working and scrambling to pay the property tax and to pay the lawn care and whatever. You know, you could trade all that. You could sell it all, move out in the country, get a much smaller place, you know, 1,000 square feet or whatever. And you could buy it outright and pay almost no property tax and have no lawn care. And you might be happier. You might be happier. You would certainly spend a lot less. Now, you wouldn't impress anybody. You wouldn't have dinner parties where people are like, wow, I love your house. Can you give me a tour? And you're like, nope. Oh, you want a tour? Go down the walking path. That's what I'm here for. But you might actually find yourself being happier. So I challenge you, or let's say I encourage you, rethink your own measures of wealth. Because I'm guessing that, like me, you have had the wrong measures of wealth your entire life. You thought it was about dollars. You thought it was about money in the bank and stocks that you own. And it's not. And of course, I'm an advocate of gold and silver, but not for the sake of having them, but rather to protect what you've earned so you can transition it into buying your freedom, buying the land, buying the solar system, you know, surviving the financial collapse so you can afford food in the future. Gold and silver are stores of wealth, but they are not to be pursued for their own sake. It's not about a competition. How much silver can you stack? You know, sooner or later, you know, you fill a couple suitcases and it's too heavy to move around anyway. It doesn't matter. It's not about pursuing the metal. It's about saving your assets as tools to help you pursue happiness and joy that come from things that are not money. Things like health and things like the natural environment, things that we're talking about here. And also having a purpose in life, for example. That's something that's very important for most people. And many of these things are available at no cost. You know, you can go outside, you can get sunshine for free, you can breathe the air for free, you can use like breath therapy, you know, you can exercise for free, you can collect your own rainwater at very low cost. You can do so many things. You can do Pilates with a yoga mat on the ground. I mean, that's how I've done it for years. You don't need a giant Pilates machine. You don't need an expensive membership. Just there's a book. There's like 100 Pilates exercises. Just do the first 10. You know, it's like lay down. Ah, I'm kicking my legs. I'm doing the bicycle. I'm, you know, it's not that difficult. You don't have to overcomplicate everything. It doesn't cost anything. How much is a yoga mat? You know, like less than $20. So my point is that the real sources of wealth in life, or what should be wealth, are available to you either for free or at very low cost. It doesn't take dollars to be wealthy. It just takes recognizing what is real wealth and what is real abundance. That's where most people falter. They spend their lives chasing dollars and missing out on the joy and the wealth that was right in front of them the entire time, or the wealth that they were born with, like, you know, having a brain that works and having an immune system that works, etc. Having a body that mostly works, even if it's not perfect. These are all sources of natural abundance, natural wealth. So I'm posting more lectures like this, or podcasts, at my online church website, which is the Church of Natural Abundance. I started the church a couple of years ago, and you can find it at abundance.church. And I used to have Bible sermons there, but instead I decided to go in this direction. So I'm posting these natural abundance. I found that my understanding of the world transcends the teachings of just like one religion, you know, just Christianity or any one religion, that they're universal truths. And so I decided to start over with content that focuses on universal, you know, natural abundance, natural wealth, why scarcity is artificial, for example, and pathways to achieving natural joy in our world of natural abundance. So I think you'll really enjoy these lectures. I think I've got 3 of them posted now. More will be coming from time to time, not on any particular schedule, but I think you'll enjoy them. So check them out at abundance.church. And in the meantime, if you want to check out my other podcasts and interviews, some about politics, some about finance, and, you know, I mentioned I interviewed Tucker Carlson, that's on decentralize.tv, or you can check out brightvideos.com, which has all my videos, or my articles are found at naturalnews.com. So check out those websites. I think you'll really enjoy them, and I thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. And be joyous. Be joyous. Recognize and experience the natural abundance that you're entitled to, you were born with, you were gifted with all of this natural abundance. And for many people, it's just open your eyes and it's right there. You just didn't see it before. It's right there in front of you. It's right within reach. You just didn't see it. So check it out, and thank you for listening. Take care.
We have some breaking news. The Iranian side has started attacking American targets today. Earlier this morning, President Trump said from the Oval Office, was kind of bragging about how he's going to launch a fourth consecutive night of strikes, and everybody was waiting for that to happen. Well, apparently the Iranians decided not to wait this time for them to get hit first, and they seem to have struck the first blow today. One can only imagine that here shortly, maybe even while we're on the air here, America will launch its retaliatory strike or the initial strike. It may not even be retaliation, but it just shows more and more of this. The ceasefire is basically over and nobody knows what we're in right now. Is this like a full on war? Is it just like, I'm just going to throw a bunch of rocks at you and you'll throw rocks at me, comparative? And towards what end? Where is this going to go? Well, we're going to talk about some of that. And we're going to talk about some of the consequences beyond what happens when missiles land. And we got back with us today, Mike Adams, the founder of Brighton Platforms and the Health Ranger. I always love that. We've had him on before, and I always follow his stuff on X every day, which you can see his X handle right there. Mike, welcome to the show. But, what do you make of this new dynamic here that instead of waiting to be hit this time and then respond, the Iranians seem to have taken the lead first?
Well, thank you, Daniel, for having me on. It's always an honor to join you. Really appreciate your show. And you're right. This escalation ladder that we're on here is going to end up in a catastrophic effects for the world and ultimately also for U.S. citizens. And that's I know that that's why you wanted to have me on today. So we'll get to some of the details of why. But this is not some isolated thing that just happens halfway around the world and doesn't impact us. If we don't find peace, if we don't restart the Strait of Hormuz through normal traffic, and by that I mean at least 100 commercial ships per day for 100 days in a row, if we don't get back to that, the consequences for the world will be catastrophic for years to come. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, we will. And unfortunately, and I hope somebody from the White House tunes into this show, because it doesn't seem that they don't seem to be aware of these compounding effects. They're just looking at the X's and O's on the attack board here and how many targets. I actually just got off the phone a few minutes ago with Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst and a friend of our show here. And he says that, listen, he goes, his analysis is put together. He said there are basically 1,000 different targets that are scattered throughout Iran that we have to try and attack. And with these 80 shots here, 100 shots here, 130 there, whatever, on these back and forth things, he said, number one, they're not that important because all the important targets had already been serviced in the first part. And the ones that really matter for control of the strait are underground. So it's not going to matter how many targets you hit because it's not going to change the dynamic that Iran is in control of the strait. On the other hand, he said that Iran only has to fire at 10 general targets, the 10 of the bases that we have in there, and they'll just continue to pummel them. And apparently that's what was going on even right now. Gary's looking to see if we can find any active headlines on that. But this just shows the futility. We are going to throw stuff at the Iranian side, and it's not going to have any effect on the main issue, which is forcing control of the Strait of Hormuz out of their hands so that we get to dictate that. And then in return, we're getting hit in targets that are all above ground. And so every strike is usually hitting something that matters to us. And the most important thing, as you pointed out, that strait stays closed.
Yeah. The asymmetry of this kinetic reality is strongly in favor of Iran. And the U.S. is fighting an uphill battle. I mean, think about it, where right now, even according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, all we're trying to do is get back to the way the strait was before Trump started this war by choice. That would actually be a win in the minds of many people. Now, just get it restored. And that's never going to happen by continuing to bomb Iran or by attempting to invade Iran, which appears to be, you know, you've interviewed guests, you've done analysis on this. It appears to be that the U.S. military is setting up conditions for a possible attempted land invasion, maybe after the midterms, who knows? But I can't see how that could be anything other than catastrophic itself. It seems to me that the only play here that is a win for Trump and a win for the world and that avoids mass famine in 2027 and beyond is for the U.S. to find a way to stop this and to leave. Let the strait function, even if Iran wants to charge a you know, 1% toll. That's certainly better than the 20% that Trump was promising yesterday.
Right. You know, it's just it bears pointing out in the context that on the 27th of February this year, the strait was open and unencumbered, and there were 100 to 130 ships per day going through like they had every day for the decades before that. It was no problem at all. Then all of a sudden, here we come. We tried bombing. Then we tried a blockade to blockade the blockade. That didn't get a thing open. Then we tried the MOU. And then here's the really weird part. Had we just said, okay, we got this MOU, we signed the document that said paragraph number 5, the Iranians get to administer this thing for 60 days without charging a toll, but they get to decide how the thing's going to be open. They had 30 days to get it done. If we had just done that and just set back, then we would be somewhere around 50%, maybe as much as today, because we got up to a third before we started saying, you know what? I'm going to add something in here with this southern corridor around Oman, and then that just jacked everything up. So we undid what little was being done with the MOU.
Right, right. Well said. But I also want to remind you and your audience that even if we were to restore the normal ship traffic, there are long tail effects of this that will clearly last for many, many years to come. And I think the narrative of the understanding of the ramifications of this has to shift to the downstream effects of what's happening right now, or what has already been damaged. For example, the Ras Laffan field in Qatar. So, you know, there are, I believe, 14 LNG trains there. They're not, you know, choo-choo trains. They're production facilities. Two of them were destroyed. That happened, you know, a couple of months ago when Iran retaliated and destroyed a couple of those LNG trains. The repair time on that, according to Qatar Energy itself, the repair time is 3 to 5 years. So even if Trump, if he were to sign an actual peace deal and stick to it, which seems unlikely at this point, if he were to stick to a peace deal, 3 to 5 years goes by before we get back to even just that level of natural gas. And then, of course, the downstream effects, which is part of the theme I want to discuss with you today, include, you know, aluminum smelting, which uses the cheap, affordable local energy of gas coming out of that field, for example. So if you don't have cheap, you know, economical mass scale of aluminum smelting, then you have effects all over the world in terms of aircraft production, automobile manufacturing. It will affect Tesla. It will affect medical supplies and so much more. And again, that's 3 to 5 years. But there are other long tail effects that are more in the range of 12 to 18 months, such as, for example, the shortage of sulfuric acid, which affects phosphate fertilizer production, and the helium shortage, which is now even far worse than it was 2 weeks ago, because China announced a banning of their exporting of helium. And they were, I believe, the second largest producer in the world. So, and helium goes into microchips, Daniel. And this is where Trump needs to realize this is going to come back to hurt him, his presidency, severely, because the AI infrastructure build out, you know, bubble, many people say, that bubble depends on being able to purchase high bandwidth memory and microchips that are manufactured through UV lithography, which uses helium. If you don't have helium, you can't make the microchips and you can't fuel the AI bubble. And then you're going to have some kind of, you know, major correction. The semiconductor crash, for example, could happen. What's that going to look like under, you know, under the Trump administration? Not
and
good.
By the way, we have some breaking news here. Gary's just put this in. We talked about this was a possibility this morning. Now, apparently it has happened. The MOU with the U.S. no longer stands, and Iran's deputy foreign minister. The parliament had said that they were going to vote on that this morning. I guess that eventually happened. And now the situation just got more complicated. Because even arguing for paragraph 5, now then there doesn't seem to be any basis for that. What are your concerns here? What is the nearest term concern that you have about a ramification, something that could be impacting on us based on what has already happened?
Well, look at the crack spreads on refined products coming from oil, such as diesel and jet fuel. This is my immediate concern. And I know this is shared by Dr. Chris Martinson, who you've had on as well. Diesel and jet fuel come from refineries set up to process the heavier oils, and they can't simply be reconfigured overnight. So I'm not saying that we're going to have run out of diesel across the board, but what I am saying is that it's very likely we will have diesel scarcity. We could have rationing of diesel, but we will definitely have a much higher diesel price, and airlines will probably be forced to cut flights, and that could include commercial freight shippers, air shippers, including, you know, FedEx and UPS, et cetera. So what that means then, everything that moves by truck in America, everything that moves by truck, your groceries, you know, your Home Depot, home building supplies, home construction, medical equipment, everything is going to get much more expensive because of the road miles required to move it around. And that could last well into 2027, especially if there's no road to peace here that seems feasible.
And with the, I think that I didn't see the today statistics. I actually couldn't find it before the show started today. But when I looked at the stats from yesterday, looking at the previous 48 hours, there had been no ships transit, despite what CENTCOM said, despite what the president said about oil gushing out. There had been no oil going out of the Southern Corridor and only a handful going out of the Northern Corridor that Iran had authorized. So even yesterday it was closed. Well, now then, President Trump said this morning there's a blockade. It was supposed to have gone into effect at 4 p.m. today. I don't know if it's going to. So that's like 25 minutes from now. But then now here the Iranian side has said, you know what? Don't even care about that. How about we just say the MOU is over? So there's nothing that's going to say it's over. We had, and I think you may have seen this, Professor Mirandi yesterday told us what the Iranian side was going to do, which was later validated by one of the Iranian officials, is that if the sanctions were not taken back off again, if the frozen assets were not released, and if Israel did not withdraw from Lebanon, then they weren't even going to negotiate. Well, now then they're saying, well, let's just add this to it, that there is no MOU. Where does that leave us right now?
Well, what's interesting to me about this is that Iran's position has been consistent this entire time, even though Trump's position has been all over the map. You know, it changes constantly. In fact, his demanded 20% toll from yesterday has apparently already transmorphed into today. He's going to demand an equivalent 20% toll as an investment in the USA. And, you know, maybe you saw my tweet on that. I said, how is the U.S. government going to collect 20% tolls from ships that are on fire? Because all Iran has to do.
I didn't see that, but well okay. said.
Well, and you get the point. You know, Iran, in fact, I jokingly said that given how narrow the strait is at that one, at its most narrow point, where the waterways is, you know, clearly territorial waters of Iran and Oman to the south, that you could buy off the shelf drones on Amazon.com that have enough range to hit ships from the shore of Iran. You don't even need military drones. These are off-the-shelf drones that can fly, you know, 20 kilometers. That's not even unusual. So for Iran to harass ships there costs them almost nothing. But for the American military to defend those ships costs a fortune, and it isn't logistically feasible in the long run. I mean, you know, Daniel, you served, you know about logistics, supply lines, and how complicated it is to have a force that's a forward, you know, and a FOB with all the food and the medical and everything that's required. You can't maintain that forever halfway around the world. We just can't do it.
You know, I even remember something more granular during my last combat deployment into Afghanistan in 2011. We had one of these forward outposts in the Kunar province that took an entire brigade once a month and sometimes twice a month, but for just to get supplies to the forward of FOB. And so we had to have air cover to go because the Taliban had access and control of all the terrain on either side of the one road that went in and out. We were always getting harassed, and sometimes we even suffered casualties, et cetera. Everything just to get one forward operating base, just so that they keep having supplies. And that they basically did nothing. They just existed there. And that's one situation on the ground that's a relatively small. Now, you talk about this, and it's orders of magnitude more. And again, It doesn't cause anything. You said about the fire. Just look at this short video right here.
There's been a flurry of Iran firing on commercial shipping, where the Dutch shipper Stolt Tankers now confirms that one of their tankers, flagged the Stolt Magnesium, flagged out of Liberia, was hit. That started a fire in the engine room. And when we are seeing these strikes on the commercial shipping, oftentimes they are hit in the engine room, which shows precision fire on the part of the Iranians. The crew is accounted for.
So that just continues on. And now then here there's more attacks and some of the other strikes that we're talking about, that what Iran shoots at, Mike, they hit. And whether that's HIMARS missiles that we have, some of our command and control centers, et cetera, where is this vaunted PAC-3 air defense systems that we allege to have had? Because everything is getting through.
Well, right. I mean, that's the critical point right there, that Iran has the precision capability of their munitions in order to accurately target not only ships, but also, like you said, the HIMARS facility, or installation, I think that was in Bahrain, if I'm not mistaken. Now, what this means, let me bring in a little darker chapter to this conversation. You just showed an image of a tanker ship on fire. What your audience needs to understand, and I know they do, they're extremely well-informed. That's why I'm always honored to join you, is that the infrastructure that keeps 8 billion human beings alive today, that infrastructure is being dismantled. It's being destroyed. That infrastructure cannot be repaired overnight. We already mentioned the Las Rafan field, the loss of gas, but also those tankers, like you just showed. When you are hauling natural gas or liquid natural gas, or you're hauling oil, or you're hauling other materials that are explosive that can easily catch on fire and destroy the entire ship, you as the ship owner or the ship insurer, you're not going to take any risk. You're not even going to sail by Iran if they're shooting Roman candles and bottle rockets. You know what I mean? Because it's just like they say, you know, at the gas station, don't smoke around the gasoline. You don't want your whole ship to go up in flames. And if it does, how long does it take to build a super tanker? How many years in a dry dock? Right. And how many dry docks do we have in the world? Not enough to restore. If we start losing ships, we start losing infrastructure, start losing oil fields, which are taking damage every day that they're not pumping, you know, because of the effects of you know, what happens when the oil sludge just sits there and it starts mixing with water and paraffin and everything else. Every single day that this goes on right now, Daniel, there is a multi-year impact that will destroy the ability of some number of human beings to exist on this planet. That's where we are.
Right. Yeah. And I want to get into some of the bigger problems that are coming up specifically on that feeding, because that's kind of one of your strong points here. But I wonder if you have any, and I didn't set you up ahead of time, so I don't know if this is in your area or not, but I know one of the issues that was talked about when the blockade first went into effect, actually when the war first started, is that once none of the ships were able to come out, there was all this problem with shut-in oil, because all of them, Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, everybody had problems, or nearly everybody, with they couldn't continue pumping at the same level because their storage tanks on the ground filled up and they didn't have any ships to put them into, so they had to shut it down. Well, then here comes the June, the MOU, and we say we're going to start opening this back up, so they started turning this stuff back on. Well, now all of a sudden, here it's been shut back down again. Can you speak a little bit to the potential problems for the industry itself in pumping oil, then now not pumping it and then turn it back on, back off? What is that going to do to the system?
Well, it's well known in the oil industry that if wells stay unused, even sometimes for short periods of time, sometimes just as little as a few days, but other times a few months, then you begin to lose the permanent long-term output of that well. The thing is, you don't know until you try to restart it. Once you try to restart it, then you can start to see, well, you know, how much flow are we getting? How much pressure do we have to put? How much do we have to inject into this field in order to get this out? Remember that a lot of these fields right now in Saudi Arabia are low flowing fields today. They're not high flowing fields. These aren't virgin fields that are just like, you know, just spewing oil for free everywhere. It takes more effort to get the oil out now than it did a few decades ago. When that oil stays and it doesn't move, then it starts to mix, and it mixes with water. And I mentioned paraffin earlier, and it mixes with, you know, rock and other things. It becomes much more difficult to get out. And in many cases, then the quality of the oil is also lower and requires more refining with more processing. But the other thing, Do you recall, Daniel, that when Qatar tried to restart the Las Rafan, one of its gas trains, this was a few weeks ago, that it exploded and it killed a bunch of people and blew up?
I did not see that, actually. No, that's news to me.
It's bizarre that that news came and went. And some people thought at first, they thought maybe it was, Israel sabotage or Iran sabotage. According to Qatar, it was just a mistake. They tried to turn it back on and it blew up and it's gone. Wow. So, and in fact, I'm sure Gary there can find probably a report on that. I'm not making it up. That happened and it was officially announced by Qatar. This is the problem. When you have shut down all of this gas production, now I'm talking about, liquid gas, not oil. When you've shut down that facility and you try to turn the lights back on, the pressures that you're dealing with there, the flow, the dynamics, the pipes, the fittings, everything, it is extremely dangerous and everything wants to blow up.
Wow.
So that's what I'm saying, Daniel, our world, and I'm not trying to blackpill everybody here. I teach preparedness and I teach surviving all of this. We can make it through this, but the world as a whole is far more screwed, dare I say, than most people realize.
And I want to jump back on that diesel issue here that you mentioned just a second ago, because Dr. Chris Martinson, you mentioned a second ago, he says that it's more. He said Russia has turned a massive net exporter of diesel, jet fuel and gasoline and become an importer because of what Ukraine has been doing with these long range strikes, with the encouragement and support and tactical targeting from the United States and Western Europe. He said it's no longer creating supply for the world. It's creating demand. And he says the energy crisis is worse than you've been told. And now then we have to add in additional problems here in the Strait. So how serious is this going to get? And can this be quickly overcome?
It's a very serious problem. Dr. Chris Martinson is absolutely correct. People should follow his work. He does tremendous research. And what's happening is, just as you said, Ukraine, through the help of European countries that are providing these drones and no doubt the U.S. with satellite imaging and target selection, they are able to strike the refining, the oil refiners in Russia, because Russia is vast, right? It's a massively large geographic country. You can't protect every square meter of the country against drones. And the refineries are spread out across Russia. They're very regional. As a result of many of those refineries being damaged, the repair time for some of them will be years. For others, it'll be months, but for some, years. And therefore, Russia was filling the gap of providing the excess oil that was missing out of the Persian Gulf to countries like India and China, of course. Now, that excess oil is off the market at the same time. So it's a double shock to the system of the world's energy flows. So this has become an energy war, as Matt Bracken said in a post today. It's become an energy war. Well, maybe it was always an energy war, but the energy is the chokehold of the world. And think about the fact that under Trump, NATO is destroying Russia's refining capability, when a few months ago they were begging Russia to go ahead. They were lifting sanctions on Russia.
I didn't get that. I was perplexed by that. We were lifting sanctions and then we put the sanctions back on, even though the flow is still, it's like, is the left hand aware of what the right hand's doing, or is anything connected to the brain? I guess we have to ask.
It just shows you the desperate situation of the shortage of especially the heavier oil, such as the oil that comes out of the Urals, out of Russia. And, don't forget about the gas fields, also the Yamal gas fields in northwest Russia that are so critical to the world's gas supply. But by destroying Russia's refineries and continuing to escalate the war in the Strait of Hormuz, what the West has done under Trump is they have created a double shock to the energy blood flow of the world. And if this was done, Daniel, if this was done to try to harm China, it's the dumbest strategic decision ever, because China had over a billion barrels of strategic reserves, and they're just eating into those reserves. China's going to be fine in terms of oil production for a long time to come. Who's going to suffer the most will be countries that depend on Western energy, which would be South Korea, Japan, Taiwan. Plus, eventually, the cost, the inflation is going to hit the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and all of Western Europe, which seems to be on a suicide mission with its own, you know, cutting off its own energy supply for many years. That's a different story. But the situation is dire for the West. It's survivable by China, and it's survivable by Russia. It's survivable by, you know, Persia, Iran. If Trump wanted to go to war with the three historic empires of the world, you know, China, Russia, and Persia, he's going to lose against all three.
Because they can be self-sufficient. With the issue on diesel, with all these things that Dr. Martin's is talking about, with that you're talking about here, what tools, bypass routes, whatever, does the global market have to try to, you know, kind of a shell game? All right, let's move this around here. Let's maybe a little less there, a little more here, and let's redistribute all this kind of stuff. Are there other storage tanks? What can we do to mitigate the problem? What is the industry doing to mitigate the problem?
Well, as you say, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is being drained rapidly. Chris Martinson did a report recently talking about how essentially the buffer that we have runs out, I think he said October, and he's actually being quite generous. It may not last that long. And what's clear is that in the United States, gasoline will probably not be in short supply, because gasoline tends to be a derivative of the kind of oil that we produce domestically. But diesel and jet fuel are the problems, as I mentioned earlier. And of course, the impacts of that are wide ranging. There's really nothing that can be done domestically to solve that problem. And that's why I'm talking about the downstream effects of this. Yeah, we have oil, but it's not the right kind of oil. And we don't have the refining capacity that we need to get enough of these products to run the economy that we're used to. And so what it ultimately means, Daniel, is probably a declaration of a national energy emergency, followed by the invocation of the Stafford Act, is my guess, with elements of the NDAA thrown in that Obama put in place that helps to authorize other acts to be invoked, like the Stafford Act, followed by rationing. So rationing of diesel to so much for farmers, and if you don't have enough to harvest your crops, yeah, good luck. You know, so much diesel for transportation, so much diesel for the military, etc. We could really be facing government-enforced diesel rationing before the end of this year.
So, and of course, the White House is going to want to just push that off beyond, say, I don't know, November 3rd or 4th, somewhere around there. And then they'll worry about it later. So, because it seems to me, and this is what a more specific question, even with what's going on with the Russia becoming a net importer of diesel, is there still enough in storage tanks and just moving through the systems already that maybe for another month or two, even with the Strait now being back closed again, we may not notice. Oh, it might be a little bit more expensive, but you know, $4 or $5, that's painful, but it's unpleasant, but it's not crippling, and there's still enough to go around. Is that the time frame we're talking about?
Yeah, you're correct. This will not be catastrophic in the U.S. for a few months, but see, in that also lies the danger, because people think, well, everything's available today, so nothing bad is going to happen. The thing is, people tend to not understand these very long supply chains and the timelines, or what we call, you know, the long tail of risk of these supply chains. And it, you know, it's not just diesel, it's also helium, it's also naphtha, which is necessary for, you know, food packaging plastics. It's in sulfuric acid. We haven't even really talked about fertilizers that much, and urea.
Yeah, I'm about to get to the fertilizer, but I wanted to touch on something else that you said a second ago. Because I don't have much knowledge of this, and would love you to educate me and our audience. You mentioned about the aluminum issue and how that is going to start to cause a problem, even for car makers or whatever else. Can you tell us a little bit more about that problem?
Well, aluminum smelting is extremely energy demanding, and that's why aluminum smelting takes place in the Middle East to a large extent. I mean, there are other operations around the world, including in Russia, and at least one in the United States that's still functioning, but it's extremely energy intense. So when you don't have the economical natural gas with, you know, an abundant supply that we used to have before the end of February, then you can't economically create aluminum. And so I think the price of aluminum has already risen to over $3,500 per metric ton, or maybe it's even 3,800. I'd have to check, but it has gone up much more than 10%, and it's going to continue to rise as the shortages continue. And Daniel, it's critical to understand, even though we have strategic reserves of oil, We don't have strategic reserves of things like aluminum or fertilizer or helium or naphtha or polyethylene or sulfuric acid. There's not a sulfuric acid reserve, you know, somewhere that you can tap into. When you're out, you're out. And when these things that I just mentioned, when these run out, the downstream effects begin to become rather catastrophic. Like, for example, medical imaging, all the MRI machines that run across our country, they need helium. No helium, no MRIs.
Oh, wow. Did not know that.
Well, yeah, and also microchip production and laboratory, you know, mass spec analysis. I own a lab. We do multiple mass spec analysis. You know, I bought a year's supply of helium in March, and everybody was asking me why. I was like, trust me, you'll see why soon.
You'll see.
Right. You'll so I have these massive helium tanks, these big, large canisters that come on a you know, big truck and with a lift gate and everything. So maybe I shouldn't be saying this publicly, but I have more helium than almost any lab probably in Texas. Maybe the government will come confiscate it from me under the NDAA. You know, give us your helium.
Okay. But, well, let's don't talk about that anymore then.
Yeah, right, right.
I'm maybe a little late for that, but
until that day comes, I've got a lot of helium.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't stock up on everything that way.
Yeah.
And so we don't have those reserves as a nation.
And let's get to one of the other, maybe more critical one. And then you mentioned it a couple of times here, and that is fertilizer. This is from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN here a few days ago. Strait of Hormuz crisis, fertilizer scarcity will affect next harvest and food supplies. The Director General of the Food and Agriculture Organization emphasized today that the global fertilizer scarcity caused by the disruption in the Strait of Hormuz will lead to lower yields and tightening food supplies in the latter half of 26. So here's another one of those things you're talking about where it may not happen through the rest of the summer, that things may be the way they have been, but into later 26 and then into 27, there's a problem. Agriculture operates within a crop calendar that cannot be postponed, he said. Fertilizers must be applied at specific moments in the crop cycle. If they do not arrive on time, and I could add in the proper quantities and at an affordable price, yields are reduced regardless of what happens later. What are your concerns with fertilizers?
This is where things get very serious around the world. Famine in many countries, especially Southeast Asia, but parts of sub-Saharan Africa as well, famine is already guaranteed. Tens of millions of people will face famine conditions in 2027 based on where we are right now. And every day that Trump continues this war, that situation is going to get far worse. And there are a number of reasons for this, of course, but number one, there are already populations that are marginalized in terms of food access every day in countries like Yemen, believe it or not, or Somalia. It will affect India, where the government subsidizes fertilizers for the Indian farmers to be able to produce enough food to feed, what is it, 1.3 plus billion people there. It takes a lot of fertilizer. And the normal market price of that fertilizer cannot be afforded by the Indian farmers. So the government subsidizes that. Now they're having to pay a fortune for it, which is costing the Indian government, you know, an extraordinary amount of money. But understand, there are two separate pathways for fertilizer production that are critical to understand here related to the Persian Gulf. One is the nitrogenous fertilizers that comes from the Haber-Bosch process, where you use natural gas to harvest nitrogen out of the atmosphere. You know, 79% of the atmosphere is nitrogen, but it's bound up as N2, you know, a nitrogen and a nitrogen together. And in order to break that nitrogen away, you have to have intense pressure, hundreds of atmospheres of pressure and intense heat. That process then cracks the nitrogen and then allows it to be bound into other forms that plants can absorb, because plants can't just use the nitrogen out of the air. It doesn't work that way. That Haber-Bosch process is extremely energy intensive. This is what companies like BASF, BASF were doing in Germany before the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines. They were using cheap Russian gas to crack N2 out of the atmosphere to make nitrogenous fertilizers, including urea and other forms that was feeding Western Europe. Well, those days are gone. And now those days are going to be gone for much of the world. But then there's the sulfuric acid pathway for the phosphates. So if you mine, you know, phosphate rich rock out of the ground and you're looking for a phosphorus based fertilizer, how do you get the phosphorus out of the rock? You have to have a strong acid. You have to bathe the rocks in the acid. And that acid is sulfuric acid, which is produced as a side effect of the oil that comes out of the Persian Gulf, because that oil is, quote, sour. What is sour? I mean, that's sulfur. So you got to remove the sour, which is the sulfur. So you have a giant pile of sulfur over here. You then convert the sulfur into sulfuric acid. You use that to pull the phosphorus out of the phosphorus mined rock. And then that's your other type of fertilizer, the nitrogen and the phosphorus. Both of these pipelines are wrecked right now, which means the world is going, well, not every country, but as a whole, the world is going to starve. Or let me put it another way. The 8 billion people that are currently living, who are eating largely either last year's food or the spring crops in the Northern Hemisphere, they're going to discover in 2027 that there's no longer an infrastructure to grow the food that can feed 8 billion people. And then it's just a question of which countries have the worst crisis first and how many people die in those countries. It's very clear that this is the situation we're facing. And
so again, let me ask you this. Once these crises start to manifest, are there workarounds then? Like, say, if you're like, oh, crap, well, let's get the strait opened up quickly. What is the lasting impact once it starts to manifest like you're talking about?
Again, long tail for recovery, 12 to 18 months for things like sulfuric acid. So you're going to lose, you know, a whole year of planting. And that post that you showed earlier shows you have to apply these fertilizers at very specific times. Now, remember that we're talking about countries like Bangladesh, for example. Those times for the crops in Bangladesh are very different from North America. And even in North America, there are different times, obviously, because of the latitude difference. So every month that ticks by, some country needs to be planting food with applied fertilizer. Now, we were very fortunate in North America because the spring planting season that we already lived through, most farmers were able to get most of their fertilizer. So we actually have enough food in America through the fall. But the fall planting season is the question. How much fertilizer will be available to U.S. farmers? If that is diminished even by 50%, it means that then, you know, the winter crops, or depending on the season, the springtime crops, you know, because, you know, you have like two growing seasons in Texas where I am. And, you know, there's winter wheat that grows in Montana, et cetera. But depending on the seasons, then you start to get diminished food output later this year and well into 2027, even in North America. That's going to result in more food scarcity, not mass starvation in America. I'm not saying it's going to be Mad Max, you know, cannibalism everywhere, but there will be millions more Americans in food lines. And this, combined with the higher diesel prices adding to the transportation cost of food, will make food inflation skyrocket like nothing you've ever seen. And I'm pretty sure Trump will still tell us eggs are cheaper at that time, you know, but ignore everything else that's costing you twice as much.
Yeah, then that's when you start getting to the problems. Trump has been remarkably effective at manipulating the markets and the paper price of oil throughout this whole process. It's still in the 70s, it's last time I saw, or maybe lower 80s now, which is way below what every expert, to include Chris Martinson on my show over a month ago, said that it would certainly needed to be much higher than that, because it's that signal is what people need to know to understand how their consumption needs to change. But with that wrong signal, the consumption doesn't change, which perversely starts chewing up more of it. And now that if we get into this problem where there's not any later on, then we're going to be in a real world of hurt. And like all of these things, it sounds to me like whether you're talking about the physical amount of a barrel of oil, the diesel, the fertilizers, and helium and aluminum, whatever, these things are going to start to manifest later on. And when they start to come on and you can't paper those over and you can't claim that the price is low when it's this high, it's too late to fix it. Is that right?
Yeah. You're at war with the molecules, or you're at war with the table of elements. I recently had Tucker Carlson on my show, and he's got a great sense of humor. And I shared with him what I'll share with you, that we've invented a new game. Instead of rock, paper, scissors, we have rock, paper, scissors, oil. And oil beats paper. So you can try to paper over all okay. the oil, right?
I can see that.
Right. All the paper contracts in the world, which is just placing a bet on some future oil delivery price, that won't stand up to the shortage of oil, the actual physical shortage of the molecules of oil and all the derivative products that you and I are talking about, like diesel. So paper, and by the way, maybe these oil traders, maybe they're just gullible and they believe that every time Trump says there's peace or that Iran wants to make a deal very badly, he said that like 50 times. If you are trading on that and you're gullible enough to believe that, then you're going to short oil because you think the prices are going lower. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for a very short period of time until the physical shortage arrives. And then your shorts get blown out and you lose, you know, you lose everything, especially if you're leveraged. Now, even Dr. Martinson was surprised that oil has stayed this low as a commodity price for this long. And I've been surprised as well. But we both know and realize that it can't last forever. Eventually, and probably within the next few months, oil is restored to its natural supply-demand price, which is clearly way above $100 a barrel. And according to some experts, more like $150 to $200. So that's no doubt coming.
Yeah. And there's just, as you said, there's just no way to, the molecules are what they are, and you can't spin them. You can't paper them over. They're going to apply. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see how this is going to work out here. Last thing I want to just kind of run by you, because I know I saw your X post earlier today, so I know that you're tracking on this, but for the benefit of our audience, I want to show you a couple of things here. We know, of course, President Trump said that you know, he's going to charge this 20% whatever fee. You mentioned that a minute ago. Well, here a couple of days ago, or, I'm sorry, it was a couple of weeks ago, Marco Rubio says that Iran cannot charge tolls in Hormuz. And he had this really smirky look on his face, which you can see pictured there. And he rejected the idea of transit fees. It's an international waterway. No country is allowed to charge tolls or fees on an international waterway, he said, adding that he believed all countries in this region would agree, apparently, except one. And here is General Keith Kellogg on Fox News just a couple of hours ago.
I think what you need to call this is a maintenance fee. I mean, we're using our vessels to escort those other vessels through. They've got fungible assets with the Iranians as well, it's billions of dollars that they've got that you can use to pay off shipping companies if they get damaged. But I think that the American people can be reimbursed for this and reimbursed for it by saying, look, if you haven't got the guts to come through the strait, unless you're escorted by U.S. vessels, then you're going to pay a maintenance fee to do it. Well, that's not the only place we do it at. It's down in the Malacca Straits also. So there's a way to do this. You don't call it a fee for just pure guidance to the strait, but I would call it a maintenance fee. And I don't see any problem with that.
Yeah, I don't see any problem with it. I mean, come on, Mike. It wasn't just a few days ago that we were mocking the Iranians for saying they're not charging tolls, they're charging a fee. And we said, oh, that's crazy. And Marco Rubio said, it's against international law. And now they're like, okay, never mind. Let's go ahead and do it. This is weird to me, as well as humiliating as an American.
Well, every time I want to have a really great laugh, I listen to Marco Rubio lecture the world about international law. It's really a character. At first Trump said that Iran can't close the strait. And then he said, we'll close it. And then he said, Iran can't charge a toll. And then he said, well, we'll charge a toll. And as the commander you just had on there, I forgot his
Kellogg,
rank, I'm sorry.
General Kellogg.
Yeah, General Kellogg, sorry. I'm not a military guy. I will sometimes mess up the ranks. But he's out of his mind on that. The threat of safety to the ships doesn't come from Iran. Iran has no desire to hit ships. Iran wants the ships to sail through and pay a 1% toll. The threat is the presence of the U.S. Navy in the region, which is the only reason Iran is firing at those ships, because they're trying to use a Navy route that is not approved by the MOU that Trump agreed to, which says that Iran can basically manage the strait. So if the U.S. Navy were to leave, then all of those tankers would have no threat of attack. I mean, I don't know why this is difficult for, you know, generals to understand basic economics, but
yeah,
apparently
or logic. There's so many of these things that can go along with that. And there's so many we could pick on as General Kellogg, but he said it with such confidence that, yeah, we could definitely charge a fee, because why not? Because we're American, we can do whatever we want. You know, those days are over. We just haven't figured it out yet. Because that kind of crap has happened. Well, I mean, let's go to 1992, really, all the way through. We've done whatever we wanted to. I don't care who complained. We said, yeah, you can cry if you want to. Here's what we're going to do. Are you going to stop me? No, moving on. And it worked. but that had an expiration date. Turns out that we've passed that now, and there is somebody who's standing up to us, and we don't know what to do next, except that's the only way our brains are wired at the elite level, which is rotten to the core. And that's why, because you see that they don't even hesitate to say grotesquely illogical and irrational or contradictory things. They don't even care. They don't seem to blush about it.
No.
And to me, that's going to harm and make more difficult to get the damn strait open up.
It doesn't open as long as the U.S. Navy is there, frankly. And mark my words, Daniel, the strait will only ever be under the control of Iran, period, because of geography. Because of geography, you know, if you think you can bomb away a waterway, a strait that is, you know, what, 25 kilometers wide or whatever, if you think you can bomb that away, go for it. It's kind of like that old, urban tale of a battleship versus the lighthouse. The battleship says, you know, we're the battleship and you have to move, you know, change your course 15 degrees north. And the lighthouse is like, we're a lighthouse, you know, it's your call. Trump is at war with a lighthouse, with the geography, with the mountains, with the land, with the earth. And he's also at war with the table of elements, as you and I have talked about today. Think about all the elements, you know, the helium and the sulfur and the phosphorus and so on. You can't fight the universe like that. You can't fight the geography of the planet. But until people realize that, the whole world is going to pay a price.
And unfortunately, just I don't see any pathway for sanity to return before the manifestations start showing up later, which tells me the likelihood is that we're going to get these bad manifestations maybe even later this year in the fall, maybe as early as late summer. I don't know. We'll have to see how these things come in, because right now, you tell me if you disagree, there's with that kind of mentality today that they're talking like that, and you see that the Iranian side apparently said, yeah, MOU is no longer, it's null and void, so forget about it, just wrap it up. And Trump, well, we were going to have a apparently in 2 minutes from now the blockade is going to go into effect, and we'll see what the Iranian side is going to do. And all of that does is push further to the right even the possibility of having this solved. So everything you've been talking about in this whole show is going to keep accruing trouble.
Well, and what Iran understands, because they have great strategic patience, is that eventually the economic costs to the West become insufferable. And we're not there yet. We're probably just a few months away from that, but that day is coming. And the problem is, when that day comes, even if Trump says, oh my God, this is too economically painful, too politically painful, we have to reverse course, then reversing course still takes years. So, Daniel, you know, the GOP is going to suffer so much politically from this, because for years to come, the American people are going to say, you know, Trump did that. Why am I paying more for groceries? Trump did that. Why am I paying more for fuel? Trump did that. Why can't I afford to live? That's Trump. And the Democrats don't even have to hire ad campaign companies. All they have to do is run Trump clips 24/7 during the campaign season, and that's going to win them the election. And then who knows what they're going to do with this country with, you know, all the Marxism and all the spying and surveillance and everything else. We're the American people are in a very difficult spot. I don't want to use foul language here, but my goodness, it's not good. Not good.
It is not good. And it screams for foul language, which we won't use, but
right.
But we it needs it. I think maybe, but listen, there's a lot of bad news, but man, people have got to know about the consequences and what's going on, so that no one can later say, wait, what? This happened? No, because people like you and the show here and Dr. Martinson and a number of other people, this information is getting out there. Tucker Carlson had on your show there too, you know, talking about this stuff. People need to know the truth. So people need to share this, number one, but, you know, this is the time to make your voice heard one way or the other, and to get the strait opened up, get us out of this mess here, get us out of these stupid things going on in the Russia-Ukraine war that's messing up stuff over there too with the energy stuff. We got to start digging. We got to stop digging holes deeper for ourselves before we really find ourselves irreparable. But that's just where we are.
Let me add this one last statement. We live on a planet with about 8 billion people, a little over. that depend on an infrastructure of food and fertilizer, fuel, energy, and so on. That infrastructure is being dismantled and disrupted. It's being destroyed with a triple shock. If that infrastructure goes, it can't support 8 billion people, Daniel, which means that some number of those people won't be here a year from now. The question is, who are those people going to be, and what's the world going to try to do to save them? And almost nobody realizes that's where we are. We're talking about a loss of easily tens of millions of people, maybe much more.
Yeah, and it'll no one will care about blaming anybody then, because it'll be too late and people will be dying. So that's why now is the time to try to fix some of this stuff. Thank you very much for coming on, Mike. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, sir. Always an honor to join you.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that. And please share this with somebody, more so than I don't say that too often, but I'm saying it today. As you can tell from that last comment by Mike here, it is serious here. This is genuine, real existential threat kind of thing to the world, not to just to a country, but to the mankind. We need to get this information out there so people are aware of the truth. Thank you very much. We'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Stock up on the long-term storable Ranger Bucket Set. 536 servings of clean organic superfoods for your survival pantry. Certified organic and lab tested for purity. Order now at healthrangerstore.com.